Hi, I'm Scott Hensley.
And I'm Rebecca Davis, and this is Your Health, the weekly podcast from NPR Science Desk.
On today's program, I'll fill you in on some new posts up on the blog Shots.
And we have a special guest, Nancy Shute, will stop by to talk with us about video games that get you up off the couch.
Later, we'll hear two stories about cancer treatments. Doctors are questioning one of the warning signs for prostate cancer.
And around the country, women are opting for less invasive breast cancer biopsies. But we're going to start with you, Scott, and a post from this week. It was kind of big news, especially if you have lupus, a new lupus drug out.
Indeed. The first new lupus drug in more than 50 years was approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And I think that by itself would be a big deal. But to me, it was interesting for another reason, too. It's one of the first drugs that came through because of the Human Genome Project all of the work to decipher, well, what's in our genetic code?
Wow. In what way was that related?
Back in 1996, a company called Human Genome Sciences was looking around, and they came across this previously unknown gene, figured out what it was doing, and then they worked on a drug based on what that protein that the gene made was doing. And that now is a drug called Benlysta.
And is that on the market, available for people?
It was just approved. The company says it will be available later this month. And the drug works by kind of calming down the immune system.
Uh-huh.
And lupus is primarily a disease of the immune system attacking the body. And so what this medicine will do, can do, is to turn down the cells that make antibodies against the body. And it was shown in several tests to be useful.
Okay, so we have a special guest here today to talk to us about a particularly interesting blog post. That's Nancy Shute. Hi, Nancy.
Hey there.
So why don't you tell us about the post this week? It had to do with video games and kids and sofas.
Video games, kids, and sofas, exactly. I mean, that's a toxic trio as far as most parents are concerned. And researchers at Brigham Young University were curious to see if a lot of these games that kids say actually give them exercise do that. The kids go in the basement. They say, we're going to go play Wii Sports.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it really doing them any good?
How sporty is Wii Sports?
Yeah, how sporty is Wii Sports? And there have been other studies on this, but what's interesting about this one is that they compared it both to being a couch potato and to walking on a treadmill at 3 miles an hour. So it gives you a couple benchmarks. And surprisingly, there was one of the video games they tested that was not better than walking on a treadmill at 3 miles an hour, which is really pretty slow.
Yeah.
And that was Wii Boxing.
Hmm.
So, okay, guys, no more Wii Boxing. Dance Dance Revolution did better. Particularly, they tested it with the Rock Chestnut 13, and that really got the kids going.
The Rock Chestnut 13, sorry.
You have a few bars.
But also, they tested a bunch of games that I wasn't aware of that are being used more and more often in PE classes at school.
PE classes?
PE classes. Evidently, school districts are buying these games. Some school districts have already bought Dance Dance Revolution and use it in PE class. But there's these big fancy systems that you would never have at home. They cost $10,000 or $15,000, one like Sport Wall. It's a great big huge thing you put on the wall in the gym, and kids run up and interact with it, and things light up, and you can have contests between groups and things like that. And it turns out those were really effective at getting the kids to do workout. Another one is one called Zavix, which you can actually get a home model of. It's pretty cheap. And again, you're running and jumping and doing that. So it seems like, you know, there is a justification for using these games to get kids active, particularly if they, you know, it's a different motivating force. And even the overweight kids in this study said that they enjoyed the games. So this time when the kid, next time the kids say, oh, Mom, we're just going to go in the basement and do video games, you can say, well, okay, but let's make sure that it's Dance Dance Revolution. Either that or you got a Wii Box really fast.
Yeah. Well, what about, so just balls, hula hoops, playing outdoors?
You know, all recommended, but, you know, they don't come with a console. I guess
right.
This is the rainy day alternative.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Thank you very much, Nancy. And now we are going to turn back to you, Scott, for a story that was posted this week about, well, it's sort of a science technology story about the use of diamonds in cancer treatment.
Yes, our podcast impresario Adam Cole wrote a post for the blog about some very early research, but very interesting research done in animals, mice, but it was a look by some engineers at Northwestern University at whether diamonds, really tiny diamonds, nano diamonds, could be used as a way to overcome some of the problems with cancer chemotherapy. And the work looks promising. It's way early, and I want to emphasize that, but the science was cool, and that's why we wrote about it. So the idea is that you attach a cancer drug, in the case of the experiment, doxorubicin, to these microscopic nanodiamonds. Contrary to what I thought, you can actually stick the chemical to those diamonds, and then it can form clusters. And that combination, the researchers think, could help doctors eventually use lower doses of the cancer drug, avoiding some side effects, and also make it easier on the body as far as how the drug is released over time. It may also help them overcome some of the tricks that cancer cells have to push these chemo drugs out of them before they can do their business of killing the cancer cells. So read about the technical details on the blog, but it was just the notion that there's a of all the things that you would think of to use as a way to get drugs in the body, I would never have anticipated that that was even on the possible list.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine a diamond that small. Maybe that's the diamond that I will get one day. Now let's turn to a controversy over cancer diagnosis. NPR's Richard Knox reports on a study that challenges whether a man should have a prostate biopsy if his blood has an increasing level of a chemical called PSA.
Okay, guys, fair warning. We're about to hear something many of you dread. A biopsy of the prostate gland.
Slide your bum way over here to the side of the table.
The patient's on his side on an examining table in Boston.
I'm feeling great.
He's a 57-year-old businessman named Jim. He doesn't want us to use his last name, but he was brave enough to let us watch his biopsy.
My PSA level more than doubled over the course of a year.
So Jim's doctor sent him to Dr. Michael O'Leary.
Perfect, perfect.
He's a urologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital.
The hardest part, Jim, is the probe going in.
Right.
We're going to go nice and slow.
A technician inserts an 8-inch-long ultrasound wand into Jim's backside.
Now I'm going to go ahead and put some Novocaine in, all right? A little stick, and you might feel that part, and then a little pressure.
Then O'Leary inserts a long, slender tube through the probe. It's actually a spring-loaded gun that will fire a dozen needles into Jim's prostate. Each one grabs a tiny piece of tissue.
Okay, here's the first one. Okay?
Yeah. Didn't feel it at all.
Good. Another little pop.
There are about 750,000 unnecessary prostate biopsies every year. That's a biopsy done in a man who does not have prostate cancer.
That's Andrew Vickers of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. He says the level of a man's PSA, or prostate-specific antigen, isn't a very good indicator of who should be biopsied.
The real big problem is that if you have a high PSA, you don't know whether it's to do with cancer or whether it results from a benign disease in your prostate.
Benign disease meaning enlargement of the prostate. It's a very common thing as a man ages. Many doctors recommend a prostate biopsy if a man's PSA rises above 4. And for several years, many have also focused on how much the PSA rises over time. Vickers says this seemed to make sense.
The point about cancer, it's a growth process. What really matters is how fast it's growing, not its current size. So with PSA, the thought was, well, let's see how it's changing.
But now a new study led by Vickers and published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute says this thinking is wrong.
We found out, in many cases to our complete surprise, that it didn't really tell us very much at all. Once you knew what somebody's PSA level was, their change in PSA was essentially uninformative, particularly for the aggressive cancers, the ones that we should really be worrying about.
This kind of data has already changed what doctors do in Europe. Vickers says they don't use the rate of increase in a man's PSA as a trigger for a first-time biopsy. But there are experts in America who aren't convinced. Dr. Anthony D'Amico of Brigham and Women's questions whether many of the men in Vickers' study had high PSAs for reasons that had nothing to do with cancer. They might have been doing a lot of bike riding, or they might have had sex before having their PSA test, or a recent colonoscopy. All can increase PSA. So D'Amico maintains rising PSA is a good indicator of cancer.
You are under the age of 60, and you've had a PSA rise of more than a half a point in a year, your likelihood of having prostate cancer is markedly increased, and you should have a prostate biopsy.
Still, some other U.S. experts say because of the new study, they won't use increases in PSA as much when deciding if a man should get a biopsy.
Okay, my friend, we are done.
Okay. Back at Brigham and Women's, Jim's biopsy is almost finished in the time it's taken to listen to this report.
I'm going
to
take this out.
Probe's coming out.
As long as the old way of using PSA holds, one thing is clear. It means lots of men will continue to get biopsies that don't find cancer. And many biopsies will find cancers that grow so slowly they don't even need to be treated. By the way, there's no question that Jim needed his biopsy. That's because his PSA recently spiked to 10.
This is enough of a rise that you have to explain it. It could well turn out to be benign disease, and that'll be great. I think the responsibility is for us to prove that this is benign disease.
Once a man's PSA level gets that high, O'Leary says there's little choice. A doctor has to find cancer or rule it out if he can. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
Doctors can face a similar challenge when trying to determine whether a woman has breast cancer. Research clearly shows that women with suspicious mammograms don't necessarily have to have surgery.
But as NPR's Patty Naimond reports, doctors in different states are adapting to these findings at different rates.
If you live in Florida and have an abnormal mammogram which raises the possibility of cancer, you may find yourself in the OR, undergoing surgery to remove a lump of breast tissue. According to Dr. Stephen Grobmeier of the University of Florida, like all surgeries, there's a risk of complications.
That would include the potential for a wound infection, and of course there's always the issue of scarring, which occurs whenever you make an incision on the body.
And here's the irony. For most women, the surgery is unnecessary. The American College of Surgeons says most women, almost 90% of them, would do just as well with a diagnostic test called a needle biopsy. It's less invasive, less complicated, and according to lots of research, just as accurate as surgery. Radiologist Carol Lee sees patients at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York and performs needle biopsies.
We would give local anesthesia, similar to what the dentist uses. We make a tiny little nick in the skin. It's a quarter of an inch or less.
Then, guided by ultrasound, Lee inserts a needle into the breast and takes several tiny tissue samples, which are sent to a pathologist to determine if there's cancer. The procedure isn't terribly painful, but it's no walk in the park.
It felt like an elongated shot, so it wasn't great.
Heidi Waterfield is in her mid-40s. Over the years, she's had both surgical and needle biopsies because of lumps in her breasts. And for her, there's no question. The needle biopsy is preferable.
It is a little bit painful, but it's short, and there are no scars, and it's not invasive. And so once you're done, if they find that it's nothing to worry about, then you're done.
That's not the case with surgical biopsies. Waterfield had two of them more than 15 years ago when she was just in her 20s.
At that time, I was very conservative about such things and thought, just get it out. I was young and I was frightened.
Which is a common reaction among women when the doctor tells them they're concerned about cancer. In Heidi Waterfield's case, all her biopsies were benign, and she never really needed surgery. She's not alone. Dr. Grobmeier just completed a study in Florida.
Approximately 30% of biopsies are being done using an open surgical technique. This is 3 to 5 times higher than is the national recommendation.
And it's not just Florida. Surgical biopsy rates are also higher than recommended in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania.
We think it may primarily be an educational issue. The needle biopsy has been accepted for only the last 10 to 15 years.
But nationwide, the tides are shifting, says Dr. David P. Winchester with the American College of Surgeons. He's just finished a study that shows doctors in most states are using needle biopsies. And he expects the slower states will catch up over the next few years, propelled in large part by the patients themselves.
Women in this country are pretty savvy about how to get information online. And they now come into doctors' offices well-armed with information about how to approach not only diagnosis but treatment.
There are some cases where a needle biopsy is not feasible, but if your doctor doesn't suggest it, then radiologist Lee says you need to bring it up.
If a woman is not given the option of a needle biopsy, I certainly think she should ask, why not?
Because the vast majority of women who have biopsies don't have cancer. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
And that's all for Your Health, NPR's weekly health podcast. We had production assistance from our intern, Adam Cole.
And our health blogger is Scott Hensley. You can see all the newest blog posts or browse through our archives at npr.org/shots. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.